the conference committee as a conference subcommittee. All the members of the House, the members are still on the floor. We've been sent for, and we'll keep getting them shortly. But we can put some things on the record here. And so we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 622. And the purpose is to consider proposed amendments. And those amendments will be with us shortly. So what we'll do is probably get some of these things on the record and then give you an opportunity to look at them. Really, the biggest change would probably be in the Prohibited Act, if there's very little change in anything else. So, we want to do the fiscal impact, Sherry. Do you want to?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We have received a fiscal impact analysis. And basically, the fiscal impact statement says that outside of the Economic Development Department or the other state agencies that are involved and will be affected by this act have identified minimal impact. The members have received a copy of the fiscal analysis last time, and again, there is a copy on your desk today. If there is any question, we have individuals representing the Economic Development Department here available to answer questions. If not, we can move on to the questions related to the fiscal.
Do you have any comments from the Economic Development Department? We have some of those calm up the feed.
We also have a couple of items which were unfinished business from the last meeting. The first item has to do with the legislative intent, which you have received a one-page write-up, and again, it's in the same packet of handouts in front of you. It's on the Public Utility Commission's letterhead from Commissioner John Smith, and the subject is clarification of legislative intent. The one-page write-up summarized two issues which were of interest to members, and we thought it would be important for that information to be codified and made official. In addition, there are a couple of other questions which perhaps would be helpful for Commissioner Smith to explain. So at this point, I would suggest that you call up Commissioner Smith.
Commissioner Smith, welcome. Please introduce you. And Phil, welcome too.
And Mr. Chair, the two issues that are not included in the write-up of legislative intent that I thought would bear some clarification relate to, number one, if there is concern about cross-subsidy, how would the PUC within its current framework of responsibilities and ability to address issues investigate and take appropriate action? And the second issue relates to PUC's authority over excess charge, which we thought, again, ought to be clarified.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joan Smith. I'm a member of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. And with me is Phil Nygaard. I'll ask him to identify himself for the record, please.
I'm Phil Nygaard. I'm the administrator of the Telecommunications Division at the PUC.
I'm not sure how you'd like us to proceed. The two issues that we've asked for clarification of legislative intent on are two subjects that came up during the course of consideration discussion on both this bill and 142. How quickly you forget. The first question is, do Sections 29 and 30 in any way prevent the PUC from asking the Circuit Court to fine any utility for violations of current service quality standards that took place before the Act became effective? We understand that the limit would be that now in statute, $10,000.
Okay. Do they, would you clarify that, do they in any way prevent you from...
Does the proposed bill, 622, in any way prevent the commission from finding any utility in violation of current service quality standards that those violations that are taking place now before the bill passes, or took place in the past before the bill became effective.
And your response to that?
We...
Our question to us, that's terrible. That's
the question.
Is that a question to us?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I will add my two cents. I think in terms of we just revert to sort of high school constitutional law of ex post facto and the prohibition on passing laws that are retroactive would imply that the commission has all the authority that it has today until that authority is changed. And so if they choose to take a telecommunication utility to court for service quality standards which and violations which have occurred today, they'll have to do it on today's laws. If this bill is passed and the government signs it into law on the date of its effective date, any violations thereafter would then fall under the new standards. That would be my two cents on the issue of clarifying. So if the commission is going to take a carrier to court to enforce present law, they can do that, and that should be able to continue on in the process, even though the bill passes, but is the two separate issues in terms of them. They would then have a different, they would have the automatic finding available, assuming the signing of 62 in the law after its effective date.
That's your reading on Section 29.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second question came up in our discussion at Roundtable of the effect of some of the wording in the Section 28 on universal service. And it's a little bit on the lengthy side, but we believe that given that conversation, this just captures the meaning of the new wording, which has to do with seeking to limit the difference between price and the benchmark. It's a very complicated issue as we go forward in the next 12 months. So what we're asking is whether you agree with whether those words seek to limit the difference between price and the benchmark, means that the PUC must reduce this gap, to the extent possible. Reaching this goal depends on the definition of cost, what the gap amounts to, and what a fair price is. These issues will be an integral part of the 12-month universal service process, and the decisions will be based on the record developed there. This language in Section 28 recognizes the difficulty of getting the number exactly right in the view of transition, of the transition in the marketplace. The overriding goal of the fund is to make sure Oregonians get affordable service no matter where they are, and that any company serving high-cost areas is compensated for doing so. Of course, any result must be consistent with the Telecommunications Act of 1996. We ask if that generally captures the gist of our discussion and if the committee would agree.
Any comment on that from anybody? You still had a... Could you just sort of describe your feeling of why it's impossible to get to, or why you feel in your opinion why it's impossible to get the benchmark closed?
Yes, sir, Nelson. There are a number of difficulties, one of which is that there are essentially three different kinds of companies. There are fully regulated telecommunications utilities. There are telecommunications utilities with less than 15,000 lines that we have very limited authority over, and we have no authority over the price currently. This bill doesn't change that. And then there are the competitors over which we have no authority over the price. And so it gets to be a very difficult thing to try and set price equal to the benchmark when you have little or no control over the price of most of the people or most of the companies that are involved. In addition, as Commissioner Smith noted, I think in her statement, you've got different constraints that we'll be dealing with at once. The Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996 is controlling here. We know, for instance, that the FCC is not setting their benchmark at something we would consider equal to the basic price of service, or the price of basic service. And so we have to be careful that we conform with them so that we're getting conflicting pieces of advice. We have different authority over different carriers, and I just want to make sure that everybody understands that going in, so there's not an expectation that we, within a few years, will have the benchmark exactly equal to price. We're not ruling that out, but I'd hate to say before the fact that that's not a problem. We can do that. Count on that happening.
Any further comment? Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, before, and I missed your opening statement, but I just want on the record, you're comfortable with the changes, and the PUC is comfortable with the changes that we have made to this bill, passing it out of committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Decker, we've only heard verbally about what might happen to the bill. We'd sure like a chance to look, but from what we've heard, if that is exactly what comes out in drafting, speaking for myself, obviously, and not the commission, I am comfortable.
Any further comments? We had a couple other questions here. Well, on cross subsidy, could you just sort of indicate there was a question as to what the power of the PUC is and how you view the cross subsidy issue? It's not on price caps, price caps.
Mr. Chair, on the issue of cross subsidy is complicated one, and I've asked Bill if he wouldn't mind giving his more informed opinion. In my opinion, I believe we do have authority to protect from cross-subsidies.
Chair Nelson, this bill doesn't do anything to the so-called affiliated interest statutes of the commission, which deal with the issue of cross-subsidies. So in that sense, nothing has changed as a result of passage of this bill. There are opportunities there for an investigation of possible cross-subsidy.
Can you just give an example for the record of what, how this might work? So we have some idea if you're doing that.
Yes, Chair Nelson. If for example, a company under this bill signed a contract with an affiliate, which called for the selling of a regulated service for below cost, or below the retail price, which is to be combined, we would have the opportunity to review that contract, and if there were a problem with it, we could not approve the contract.
Any comments? The other one was on the access charge. Is that what we were talking about? How is the PUC view the access charge under the proposed amendment?
Mr. Chair, we are aware that numbers of interested parties to this issue in this bill feel that we need to clarify the fact that the Commission believes it has complete jurisdiction, notwithstanding anything in the bill, over the pricing of intrastate access. It's not access lines. This is the price paid to use the networks of incumbents. We didn't feel it was necessary to put it in because we think it is clear on its face that we do have that authority, and hope that by making clarifying statement today that we will reassure those parties as well as make the record clear that we do believe that we have that authority. And I ask Phil to just fill in after me, if you will.
The most important thing here is to bear in mind that I think as a practical matter, we're only dealing with U.S. West. I believe U.S. West is the only company that's going to opt in, so to speak, or become an electing carrier. I also think it's clear, at least it is to me, that we are shortly going to be engaging in what's known as the rate design portion of the rate case involving U.S. West, in which we're dealing with a significant revenue requirement reduction. That means that all parties, including those that want to see lower access charges, will have an opportunity to come in and make their case. And if they can make a convincing case, the PUC will have the authority to lower access charges. In addition, there are federal activities in the area of access charge going on, and once we're done with our universal service fund, there'll probably be resulting state activities too. And I don't see anything in this bill that eliminates our authority to make changes there.
Just a side question. I just need to. Does the PUC have the authority then to require the IFCs to pass on those reduced charges to the consumers, or is that just something that we'll have to let the marketplace see if any of those reduced charges are there, or the commission might look and balance it out and say they'll give all the benefits to consumers on the other side or something? I'm just curious.
Mr. Mr. Chair, Representative Teel, if I get this wrong, I please ask Phil to correct me. The answer to that question is we wish.
Thank you. Further questions? I read Dick Yates was here earlier, and we wanted to make everyone comment on the...
Mr. Chair, Representative Decker asked a question at the last committee meeting, which needed to be responded to, and the economist was sitting there waiting for it. He has just disappeared. So the committee's options are when you resume the meeting after the recess, we can ask him to come back and speak to that question, as opposed to hearing and wait another minute.
Yeah. If you want to step up here. And...
Mr. Chair, the question raised last time, as I understand, is out of the, what portion of the carrier's communication infrastructure account would be true out-of-pocket cost outside of tax benefits, write-offs, etc.? Is that the correct question?
By and large, that was the question put forth. Or the other side of the coin, what would be the tax advantages within that electing $120 million pool?
Dick Yates, Legislative Revenue Office. Cannot give you, concrete answers to those questions. Basically, I think what U.S. West will have to do is get an IRS ruling as to how they would characterize those expenses. And I asked the auditors over at the Department of Revenue who deal actually with the tax returns to help me out and give me some advice. There are, first of all, with respect to whether or not it might constitute a charitable contribution, probably not. This is not something that's freely given. Okay, so that's out. And that's probably not bad from U.S. West's perspective because there are limits on what they can write off as charitable contributions anyway. What remains then as probable characterizations would either be that it is something that's paid to produce something of value and therefore must be capitalized, in which case it would be depreciated. Better from U.S. West's perspective would be to have it characterized as an ordinary necessary business expense. Right. So if this money is set aside and that's part of the cost of doing business, that's an ordinary necessary business expense, and therefore that's an expense which is going to reduce their taxable income for both U.S. federal tax and Oregon tax purposes. So you've got basically two different types or directions in which money is going here. One is money that will be used to invest in projects like fiber optics and so on. Those are ordinary, essentially, as I understand it, those will be the property of the company, and so they're just treated like any other investment the company might make. The value invested will be capitalized and depreciated over the expected life of the facility, and so that's just a business activity. There's no special tax advantage in a sense, which accrues because of the way in which this is set up. For the monies that go into the Connecting Oregon Communities Fund, the company doesn't really get anything for these, and that's why they might very well be characterized as ordinary and necessary business expense. To the extent that they are, then you've got the federal tax, corporation tax is graduated, but roughly around 3 to 35% would be essentially savings, if you like, or a offset to the cost of the 120 or whatever goes into the Connecting Oregon Communities Fund, which is Thirty-five percent, maybe, or 40% overall of the total amount of money that you're talking about. That amount would be an expense that would offset income from other activities And so to a sense, essentially the federal government would be sharing that cost on about a one-third basis. And the Oregon would also share that cost, but on a much smaller basis in terms of about 6.6%. I think that's about the best answer that I can give you. I can't tell you how many dollars they're going to get back because I don't know where these are going to go, and I definitely don't know how IRS would characterize.
Can you throw a ballpark figure out there? I mean, that was the cut to the chase. I'd heard from the, if it was contemplated $120 million in terms of investment, I'd heard as far as 80 might be returned, and that, with limited knowledge of the tax system, seemed to be excessive to me, and just wanted to put the question to you. Does that seem in the ballpark, or do you have a ballpark figure?
Well, I do not have a ballpark figure. That seems high to me.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you're talking, I think, more probably like about, for over a four-year period, you've got 30% of the money which is going for the first 2 years and 20% for the next 2 years, which is going into the Connecting Oregon Communities Fund. I think that's the only money that we're talking about. So you're talking about, I don't know, it's 120 over the 4 years. Is that the total amount over the 4 years? That's not 120 a year, right?
The projections.
So you'd be talking about, you know, roughly 30% of that to begin with. So that's $36 million, and the government sharing about a third of that, maybe 40% of that. So I think you're in the range of 15 to 20, 25% at most.
Thank you.
Any questions? Oh, you have to go into recess here for about 1:30.
Is it fairly interesting when the system?
No. No, so we'll be in recess until 1:30 unless there's further questions.
1:30?
Yeah. Okay. We also have a call of the parents. So we just work on this about
that long bill.
We'll call the work session back to order after our recess, and had an opportunity to at least look over the prohibited acts. Okay, yeah, we have, yeah, Sherry, do you want to make a...
I move the Senate concur in the House Amendment dated June 9th and the bill be further amended by the Dash 31 Amendment.
Okay, just Representative Hill has moved. What would you move again here?
I move that the Senate concur in the House Amendment dated June 9th and the bill be further amended by the Dash 31 Amendment.
Okay, discussion.
Any
discussion there? Representative Montgomery.
Chairman, I'm going to be a no on this. I just want to take 1 second and compliment you for this. When 142 came over here, I probably could have supported it. It's now turned into the school funding, and I have a district issue that couldn't be addressed, and the committee took a look at it. I appreciate that. I just want to explain my no vote, and thank you for all your work.
Yeah, thank you for all your work. Thank
you, Chair. If we could have someone from the PC get up
to
our question or two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joan Smith. I'm a member of the Oregon PC.
Mr. Smith, I have one very quick question for you. You have had the opportunity to at least give a cursory look at the Dash 31, and this reflects the agreement that you have reached, or and feel at least with a brief look, and certainly not committing yourself and wouldn't hold you to that, that this looks like the agreement that you have reached.
Mr. Chair, Representative Decker, it looks like the agreement that was described to us this morning and it appears as reasonable as we could hope for under the circumstances. Mr. Chair, Representative Decker, no one actually directly negotiated with us on what should be in here. I think I should make that clear, but we are allowed to review everything that was discussed.
I'll settle for that.
Any further discussions? Questions? Roll call vote. Senator Barnes?
Representative
Jackson?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Montgomery?
No.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator
Nelson?
Aye.
Motion is carried. Senator Chair, Representative Hill, Senator Nelson.
I just need to say for the record that I only had a cursory view of this. My position could change after looking through the details, but appreciate the process and appreciate the input. And
thank you for your efforts. I appreciate that.
I don't know.